If you've had enough, or had near enough, sick and tired of that old man looking down on us, come together, as we think we got a plan. Save a teeny tiny traveling folk band. Hey everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Flat Nickel Podcast. I am your always producer and occasional co-host, Sam Fritz, filling in for Hannah this week, as she is a very busy person, and she needed a little bit of time off, so I was put in charge this week to get the interview set up, done, and all the other stuff that she normally does. It's in my hands this week, and hopefully you guys still enjoy it. Substitute host week doesn't cause all of you guys to go running the other direction. Please stay with us. This was a fun little interview with a band called Winnie Brave. I found them actually after we posted our episode with the Rough and Tumble last week. They liked our episode. They liked the stuff that we'd been putting up on social media, and I sort of just saw them, saw the Rough and Tumble, and I went, this kind of makes for a great comparison. You know, they kind of have similarities between the two. Of course, our interview doesn't actually draw upon those comparisons. I didn't want to try and say that they were the same band. That's not fair to either of them. But, you know, I was transparent in letting them know that, like, you guys clearly have a similar thing going on, just you're now out of Canada instead of the Rough and Tumble, who are based out of Pittsburgh. So we took the time to talk. I thought it was a great interview. Amy and Brad were both super friendly people, so easy to get along with, very accommodating. Would absolutely love the chance to get to talk to them again. This is one of our shorter episodes. It's only a 30-minute interview, but to substitute that, we also have a Sam Interviews the World segment for this week. It is going to be with Erica Schultz, who is a comic book writer. She's worked on Daredevil. She was in the DC feature last year, 2018. DC feature. And she also has done original works like M3, which is a crime drama. Really great stuff. An exciting interview. Both of these are phone interviews. Due to my location and the busyness of the week, it was really the only way that I could get these things done. But I think you're going to enjoy both of them. You get a really interesting perspective from Winnie Brave, being an Americana band in the Canada scene. And then you get an interesting perspective from a comic book writer who, as you know, what we like to promote on the show is independence and being an independent artist. And when I do these Sam Interviews the World segments, the main goal is for them to be independent other people, not just independent musicians, independent artists in the actual physical art sense, like my sculptor friend Aaron, who was in the first one. Or, in this sense, an independent artist, like an independent writer or illustrator for comics. You know, it's kind of a same goal, different format as a writer or a illustrator for comics, of which Erica Schultz does both. So, hopefully you guys will enjoy those. And I think with that said, let's get into the interview with Winnie Brave. Okay, cool. I'm using a microphone setup that's a little bit different than what we normally use, so my phone's in a bit of a weird place to do this interview, but can you go ahead and just do a real quick introduction for the people who will be listening to this?
So we are Winnie Brave. We are Brad and Amy, husband and wife, Americana roots, funk, rock, yard sale band.
Yeah, so we spent most of our time traveling in a 1976 Winnebago, from which we took our name. We are named after a recreational vehicle. And up until a few weeks ago, we have upgraded to the 20th century of, we've got a Dodge Sprinter now. So we've got air conditioning and cruise control, and we are seeing a lot fewer gas stations on our travels.
That actually was one of my very first questions, was that I saw the combination of Winnie in the name and driving a Winnebago, and I actually, when doing research for the interview, saw that you guys retired the Winnebago on Facebook. And not to start this interview off too heavy, but was that kind of an emotional moment for you guys, retiring a vehicle that you traveled in for so long?
It had, we would call the Winnebago a guilty pleasure. It was comfortable, and it was cool in an unmeasurable factor. But oftentimes, things that are fun but expensive, the practicality wears out pretty quickly. So, with the ever increasing cost of fuel and our tendency now to travel a little bit more in Canada and the northern U.S., gas guzzling, mountain fearing, not well insulated mid 70s motorhome is not ideal for long runs. So decided to make the change. It was emotional. We've got her in the backyard still, and she may find some service next summer when we go out for nostalgia runs out to campgrounds around Alberta. But yeah, her days of rock and rolling are done.
It's funny because the van that we transitioned to is a lot smaller, and it's funny, like, just sitting around on the days off or the hours in between having to play and getting up in the morning, the Winnebago had such a sprawling living room, and I mean, we traveled in posh style, and now that we're sitting in this, like, little van, we're like, oh man, I wish we had the Winnebago, but holy cow, like, the amount of gas we go through was just crazy. We were working and playing all these shows basically just fill up the gas tank, which was not doing much for our bank account. So hopefully things are now be a little more profitable.
I actually managed to find you guys through the Rough and Tumble, who are very good friends of the podcast out here on the East Coast. And they kind of have a similar setup to you guys of they basically packed everything. They moved, they packed everything away into a camper, and they've been basically living in that, you know, touring on the road for years now. And I saw your guys' story began, on your website, I think it says that the story began in 2012?
2012, 2013 was when it first kind of all started. Yeah.
When, or not just when, but like the mental process of when you guys decided to pack everything up. First off, where were you guys at, you know, physically, like in the world? And then second off, where were you at mentally, and what led to the decision to just give it a go and, you know, leave everything behind?
So the first incarnation of it, Brad and I were basically very much in the real world. We both had 9-to-5 jobs. I commuted over an hour each way to work. Brad was on shift work, so sometimes, or for 2 weeks he would work nights, and for 2 weeks he would work days, and random, you know, it wasn't like Monday to Friday, it was all over, so we barely saw each other. We had a house, we had, you know, two cars, and all this sort of thing that, you know, life kind of throws at you, and you think you're supposed to do, and I think we just got to a breaking point. And I remember being like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to be stuck doing this for 30 years and seeing Brad like every 3 days. And nothing felt right. So we decided to put our house up for sale and kind of see what would happen. And so our house went up for sale, and it was less than 2 days before it was sold. And so we decided we didn't want to buy anything else. We didn't want to move closer to the jobs we hated. So we closed the house. We sold most of our stuff, and we went and bought a little travel trailer and a truck, and packed up the dogs and the stuff that we knew we wanted to bring with us, which was our instruments and some other random things. And we just hit the road, and we did that for about 4 or 5 months. It was we were in Ontario, Canada, so it was over the winter time, so we escaped winter. We went down to Texas and did a big road trip through the Southwest and back up, and we kind of thought we had it out of our system, so we went back to Ontario, and we opened a guitar shop, and I went back to work as a graphic designer, and on paper, everything was great. You know, we were doing something that a lot of people set out to do, opening their own business, and it was fun. And I remember Brad and I went over to this pub that was across the road from the guitar shop. And this was like a couple months into this new life that we had started. And we both just kind of looked at each other and said, you know, this doesn't feel right either. So we went searching for the 70s Winnebago. We both really loved how it looked and thought, yeah, let's go travel in one of those. We ended up finding one and we bought it. and it was just a yard sale of an RV. It needed so much work. But we slowly, we put a brand new roof on, and we were going to redo the whole interior. And then a couple months later, we found the exact same Winnebago up for sale again. And this one had some engine mods and some other really well-improved features. So we bought it. So we had two of the exact same 1976 Winnebagos. And I think it was about a year that we worked on restoring it and got it road ready. And we closed up the guitar shop and did that whole process of clearing out all our stuff again and put everything into this 23-foot RV. And that's when we hit the road for, I think we were on there for 9 months. And we played all throughout the United States and across Canada, and that was kind of it. We knew that this was, everything just felt right with that. It was like, okay, now we kind of feel like we are where we're supposed to be.
So you guys, you know, sell everything, start this new life for the second time, and you decide to just really commit to music. One thing that we explore on the show a lot is how artists, especially independent artists, book their own tours. So now that you've, you know, again, kind of back to when you first started doing this full time again, what was your process of getting shows? How did you start putting yourself out there?
We were working pretty steadily in and around Ontario while we were maintaining our full time jobs, and we sort of built that network through, firstly, you know, email contacts with venues local to our area, and then we just started sort of building our brand. If we found a venue that we enjoyed and we had a good relationship with the staff there, we would try to repeat those gigs. You know, we'd go once a month or more. And that's how we sort of molded our marketing plan, if you want to call it that, the way in which we sort of designed our webpage and came up with what we thought was an effective email to open up a line of communication with the venue. We felt like our social media presence was adequate and that we presented ourselves in a professional way. So when we decided to go on the road, we sent out more than 1,000 emails to land maybe 50 or 60 gigs over that first 9 month tour. But I mean, we went all the way from Charleston, South Carolina to Austin, Texas to San Diego, California, into British Columbia. Like, we went all the way around the outside. So that was a bit of an eye opener and a warm up, per se, you know, getting used to being on the road that long. But the gigs, it was just a matter of ensuring that we had a visa so that we could cross the border and work without any logistical or legal problems, and refining our communication by firstly sending out as many emails as we could to as many venues as we thought were suitable, and then making sure that we were pricing ourselves accordingly so that we weren't too expensive, but we were still earning what we needed to earn to survive on the road. And frankly, man, we're still learning. We still have to send as many emails as we ever have.
It gets a little easier. I feel like now that I've been on the road and gone through, you know, a couple different loops through Canada and the U.S., we have content that we have, like Brad was saying, and then you just kind of build on it. I remember we actually have met the Ruffling Couple a few times now. Mallory and Scott are, we consider them road friends. They're pretty great. And if we're in the same town, you know, we'll usually hook up and grab lunch and swap stories. But I remember when I first came across them, I think I found them on Instagram maybe or Facebook, I can't remember. So I was like, oh wow, look at this, another traveling band. So then we pillaged their dates. We went through their catalog and we're like, okay, where do these guys play? And I feel like that's what a lot of musicians do. I'd heard that it's funny, we'll play in a town that we'll find close to home that maybe doesn't do music at all. So we'll start playing there, and sure enough, you start to see other bands play there, and being cute researchers that we are, we'll go look at their dates, and it was usually a lot of dates that coincide with places that we've played, and so I think, I mean, that makes sense, to find bands that travel and look where they play, and if you play the same kind of music, it makes sense that, you know, your stuff may fit at these places, breweries, distilleries, anywhere with purveyors of good alcohol are good places to start. So, yeah.
You brought up road friends there for a little bit, and I think that's kind of an interesting topic to go off of, especially for musicians who travel as much as you guys do. Traveling with your dogs and also having these road friends, do you find that those are necessary mental, you know, boosts that can help you get through these tours easier? You know, it kind of, I guess, kind of explain the concept of road friends to me, you know, a little bit more.
I think it's, for us being on the road, and I think same as for the Rough and Tumble, the more people that you meet along the way, it makes touring feel less isolated, I guess, because, you know, great friends and family are peppered throughout the way, and you get these little snippets of home and comfort, and whether you are welcomed into the houses or, you know, restaurants that you became friends with the owners, and it's just this feeling of family, and I think that's important, because the first time we toured, when we were on the road for 9 months, we didn't know anybody, and Brad and I get along pretty well, and people are usually amazed that we can spend as much time together as we do, but it's funny, when we have all these little stops now, and we've built them up now the more that we've been on the road, but we look forward to these times where we get to visit and see people again, and just have these moments of comfort, and yeah, I don't know, they're nice little stars and breaks along the way.
You guys are Canada based. Were you also Canada born? I wasn't able to find where you guys are from originally.
Yes, we are both from Ontario. We're both born and raised there. We now live in Alberta. We moved out there last year. We bought a little house. After being on the road for so long, it's funny, we kind of had this yearning to have a home base again. And so we found this cheap little house in this middle of nowhere town. And it is so comforting after being on the road for 4 or 5 months to go back and have all your stuff and your couch and a TV and a big bed and a big shower and all these little things that I think a lot of people take for granted. But for us, after being on the road, it feels so good to be able to come home and just stretch out and have that feeling for, you know, a couple weeks or a couple months. Correct.
Yeah, that is one thing that I've noticed with a lot of the artists who we talk to, is that even though, you know, especially I think in the case of you guys in the Rough and Tumble, who you clearly are dedicated to the craft enough to travel so many miles and in such an amount of time, but it always feels good to have something to come back to, something to, you know, that is kind of some kind of permanence, because I think when you're traveling on the road so much, you kind of lose touch with that, if that makes sense at all.
Yeah, and I feel like I felt it more so. It's funny, after 4 or 5 months, it was kind of like, you know, even if it was just for like, you know, a week, I just want to go somewhere that's kind of like a recharge. And I feel like that was so important to us. And that's why when we found this little house in this little town, and it was perfect. And we've met so many amazing people in this town, and they've become family because all our family is back in Ontario. So being 3,000 kilometers or so away from them, we now have this pseudo family that are just the greatest people, and it makes going out on the road so much easier now.
Part of the reason why I brought up Canada, you know, being born and raised in Canada, is I wanted to see if you guys have any comparisons or differences between the Americana folk country scene from, you know, between Canada and the United States, because I'll be honest, and this is a little bit of my own bias in the kind of music that I just generally, you know, seek out, but a lot of the stuff I see coming out of Canada right now is the alternative rock and roll sound, kind of. But can you give me any idea of what the folk scene is like out there in Canada?
Canada's interesting. It's sort of regional in the way that music is favored by people. One thing that's, dare I say, unfortunately true is that what Amy and I call shit kicker country, pop country, your sort of modern FM country. Honestly, I couldn't even name an artist, but your modern day country pop stuff. heavy in Alberta, but it's heavy coast to coast in Canada. And second to that is to the tarnished remnants of the Nickelback era, I guess, to some extent. But
rock.
There's a really interesting undercurrent of traveling Canadian musicians who have never really surfaced as commercial successes, but that have really good draws all over Canada. Bands like Blue Rodeo are sort of the founding fathers of alt country Americana in Canada. Kathleen Edwards, just lots of, never really got hot in the States, but really have driven what we would call the sort of folk Americana market north of the border. There's a lot of exceptional singer-songwriters that just don't get that type of mainstream notoriety. But, you know, we get our hands full with, you know, Jason Isbell and Dawes and Shovels and Rope and bands like that out of the States that are doing very engaging versions of country and folk and Americana. So we're not suffering a shortage of music per se, and neither are engaged Canadian listeners. The problem is, just like any other sort of modern media market, if all you listen to is FM radio, then all you're going to get is a bit of fluff and cotton candy, mostly disguised as country music. But there's magic out there, that's for sure.
There's a really strong, folk music we find in Canada, or the modern folk music, the pool is extremely deep. And I mean, there's people that I come across that I've never heard of, and then you look and they have won tons of awards, and they've constantly toured Canada, and they've been doing it for years, and you just hear about them. There's a huge folk market up here that we haven't even delved too far into, and there's conferences for it, and again, all the folk festivals, and it's just like stacked lists of people that have done amazing, wonderful things. And it's like, how have I never heard of this person? You know, how come I've never heard your stuff? And they're just amazing. But I feel like that's probably the thing everywhere, right? There's this mass of creative musicians doing everything under the sun. And once you start to look a little deeper, you're going to wade into that pool. And it's just amazing what is out there. But we certainly don't have a shortage up here, that's for sure.
I want to kind of dig into a little bit of, at least the way I have it written down in my notes here, is the band aesthetic. Clearly, I think the Winnebago is a big part of your guys' – I mean, it's the cover of actually your self-titled album, Winnie Brave. And then also I notice a lot of coffee and diners and pictures of that stuff on your social media. Also, your second album, Cheap Gin, is you two pouring or having a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
Are these just aspects of your life that you've chosen to highlight through your music, or did you guys kind of set out to make these things a part of the band brand, for lack of a better term?
I think they are more. This is who we are. I think I don't think, like, we didn't take the diner shots. Be like, well, let's do this because it looks cool. It's like when we're on the road, we try to find greasy spoons. If we're going to splurge, you know, to eat out, that's usually what we'll do. We love a good breakfast restaurant. And, yeah, obviously the Winnebago is part of it, a huge part of it. I don't know what we're going to do now. The Sprinter van is not as visually appealing. So I doubt we'll do a photo spread with the van. But, yeah, I think, I don't know, just as this is just aspects of who we are. There's the little diner that we took those photos in was a little greasy spoon in the town of Orillia called the Tasty Diner. Brad and I have had breakfast there numerous times, and it was just a funky little place. I remember one time, it was up for sale, we teased the idea of buying it, which we never did. But, yeah, I don't know. That's all it is. It's just little bits of who we are.
I think Scott and Mallory, if they were on the line too, they would probably agree and say that when you're contacting places, venues for the first time, you need to present some type of a multifaceted but immediate impression, something along the lines of professional and employable, but entertaining and unique. And it's sometimes it's hard to present that on the title page of a website or something like that. So you do need, I think, to share as quickly as possible a story that is at least engaging. I can say in a personal experience, there's been many a time where we've received a response to an email saying, "Oh, you guys are just the cutest," or "We love the traveling," or something like that. And it's, you know, we've never met these people, but on cold email searches for gigs, people respond and confirm our effort that we're providing an impression of ourselves via our social media. And I mean, I wouldn't instruct anyone as to how to go about doing that, but it is a very important factor to consider. And I know that Scott and Mallory have their teeny tiny folk band tagline, and they do a great job of presenting themselves as a very organic, you know, family business, and we try to do the same. It's important to present something simple and immediately effective.
Speaking of branding and part of your guys's, you know, kind of look, Brad, I wanted to actually ask you quickly about your setup, because you're known in the band as the one-man band where you play multiple instruments. And very uniquely, I've noticed you own quite a lot of bass guitars that are very rock and roll, at least in my opinion. I mean, I saw when I was doing research, you have an SG, and it looks like you have a Firebird as well. Of all the basses that you own and collect and that kind of stuff, what one is your favorite to play if you had to pick one?
I have to first admit and hope for support in this and saying that I'm a recovering gearaholic. guitar pedals and tube amplifiers and guitars have been a bit of a crutch of mine for a couple of decades. I'm proud to say I'm down to one bass guitar amplifier. I have two bass guitars, a 2011 Gibson Thunderbird, a very rare short scale model, and recently acquired my second bass guitar, which is an Airline 2P bass guitar.
It's very rock and roll. It's very rock and roll. New, and it's not in many pictures, but it looks very Jack White-esque.
Ooh, yeah. that's I'm happy to hear that.
The SG, the SG is it's not my fault that guitar is gone. That initially we were going to both play SGs for a tour, and we got matching essentially Fireglow Gibson SGs, and then somebody wouldn't play theirs, so they both got sold. And like I said, we're down to the Thunderbird and the 2P. Amy has two flat top acoustics. We each own two guitar pedals now, so I would say as a gearaholic, I have my condition under control. I've gone through several of the steps. I call my friends daily and apologize for some of the things I did wrong when I was really, really addicted to gear and the way I treated them. So we're getting better.
I'm glad that you're on the road to recovery.
Thank you.
Moving from Brad's instrumentation, Amy, to your lyrics, and I think one thing that's very important to ask any folk, Americana, country, anybody within that realm, is how you choose to go about the writing process. You know, what when you're sitting down to write, what stuff do you use as a muse? What do you use to really get sparks flying? And, you know, most importantly, how do you find your voice when you're writing these songs? Because I think any country artist would argue that your voice is one of the strongest things about your songs when you're in that realm.
So it's actually been a while since I've done any writing. I've been in this non-writing phase, but for the longest time, I mean, before Brad and I met, I was just playing solo. And so obviously I just, you know, would sit there with my guitar and try to write something. It's funny, for me, it's sometimes like pulling blood from a stone. Like, I'll sit down with the intentions to write, and I'll strum a few chords, and I just, it's not there. And I can't even force it. Nothing happens. So I usually get discouraged and put my guitar away. And then other times I'll sit there and I'll just strum a few things and out comes the song. And that's usually how it works for me. I don't have to half write something and put it away. It's like if the song is there and it's ready to happen, the whole thing just comes out all at once. And it's usually a fairly quick and painless process. For the very first Winnie Brave album, a lot of those songs got written in the course of a week. I think that was the week that our guitar shop opened. And I just remember sitting, you know, upstairs in the apartment, and each song just kind of came out. Like, I think in 5 days, I wrote 5 songs, one song a day. It was just crazy how quickly they came out and painless. And then when we went on the road, Brad and I started working at writing together. So he would kind of, we wanted to have some more groove-based songs, I guess. And so he would, you know, write some licks and stuff on the bass, and I, you know, I just kind of get those going over and over in my head, and then the melody and the lyrics would just kind of come out. Like, I don't know, I wish I had a more eloquent way, or, you know, things I can describe of how I write, but it just, it's either there or it's not there. I have, you know, a notebook that if I have interesting phrases or if I come across things, I'll jot them down, and when songwriting time is there, I might just flip it over and flip it open and find a phrase or something, and that might kickstart it. Or other times, you know, I'll just put my pen down and out it flows. So for me, that's how songwriting works. It's kind of rudimentary, maybe. I don't know. Certainly not flashy.
No, I think that's totally how it is for some people. You know, it's just always worth asking. But for a lot of people, I think, myself included, for sure, when I try to write music, it's just, it's either there or it's not, you know, and I'm, you know, just one of those people who can't force myself to write a song, kind of like how you were putting it.
Yeah, it doesn't work.
I want to ask one final question to kind of lead you guys into the end of this, and you can both answer it separately or together. I don't want to cause any fights, so to talk amongst yourselves. But one thing that we like to ask some artists here is a dream gig. If you could pair yourself with another artist, dead or alive, somebody that you would like to play music with, who would you do it with?
Oh, boy. Brad's pointing at me to go first, and now I'm just like, oh, I don't know. Greg, I have so many, like, favorites that I just think would be amazing. Oh, gosh. Right? Okay, if I'm going to answer right now, I think I don't know. I don't know. Do you know?
I have my answer ready.
Well, then why didn't you go first?
So, strangely, but repeatedly over the last several months, I've had dreams about Jason Isbell.
Jeez.
Not that we're in a relationship or anything like that, but, like, we're hanging out in our buses at festivals, and we have this very unique relationship, or so is the feeling I get when I wake up from these dreams of Jason Isbell. So for no other reason than obviously something in my subconscious believes that in the future that is a relationship that shall exist. I will pick maybe playing bass for Jason Isbell would be my dream gig right now, or maybe opening for Jason Isbell so that we can hang out on the bus.
Would you play bass and drums for him while he plays guitar?
No, I'd rather just open.
Amy, okay, have you come to an answer yet?
So right now I would say, in the movie The Last Waltz, when the Staple Singers are singing with the band on the soundstage for The Wait, I think that would be pretty epic. I would like to sing with both the band and the Staple Singers, and I think that would be pretty cool. If I could have been at that concert, at the last Waltz concert, and, like, coming in and off stage and with everybody who was there, that would be my ultimate dream gig.
All right. Well, hey, guys, I really want to say thanks for taking the time to do this interview. It was awesome getting to talk with you guys. And this interview should be coming out this Wednesday, actually. So if you want, I'll make sure to send you guys a message so you can share it with anybody who you think would be interested in hearing it, social media, all that stuff. But again, I really want to say thank you for taking the time to do this interview.
Thanks, Sam. And yeah, we'll definitely share it. I look forward to hearing it.
Awesome. You guys have a great day.
So that concludes our interview with Winnie Brave. We're going to jump into the Sam Interviews the World segment with Erica Schultz here. And this was done over the phone in a position in which my voice just was not picked up very well by the microphone. So I'm going to format this one a little bit differently. I'm going to kind of lead in to her responses with these formal introductions and then cut to the clip of her talking about it, just because I want to save the audio quality of her voice, and I don't want to ruin the audio quality of the questions that I was asking. Either way, for part one right here, for this first bit, it's going to be her kind of talking about how she got started in the writing process of becoming a comic book writer.
I always wrote and drew stories. I was always drawn to the idea of storytelling, whether it be visual through film or through music, because I think you can tell stories through music as well. Just that idea of telling stories through any form of creative medium that other people can absorb. And I didn't think anything about writing comics. It was more or less just telling stories, writing stories down, and finding a medium to express those stories. I had had a car accident in 2008, and while I was recuperating from that, I had started writing this idea that ultimately became M3, which was the first comic that I had done. And not long after the car accident, I sort of stopped recuperating early so I could get a job, because at the time I was out of work, and I started working at a studio in New York City doing Photoshop work and digital art and things like that. And the head illustrator at the studio was doing comic book work, so I became familiar with the production aspect of it, the timeline, how to format your scripts and such. And I thought, you know, I have some stories that might lend themselves well to the comic book medium. And so I approached another artist who was working at the studio at the time, happened to be Vicente Alcazar, who was the co-creator and an artist on M3, and we decided to do M3 together and put it out. We pitched it to multiple publishers, and none of them bit, so we ended up doing it all on our own, which was a huge task, but it was a very big learning experience. So I can say that I've taken a comic from, you know, two lines on a napkin to being in Diamond and, you know, being distributed all over the world.
One thing that you mentioned about M3 is that you started writing it after the car accident, but you didn't actually start writing it originally as a comic. It started as something else.
It was just ideas. Really, it was just ideas about this particular woman and trauma that she had suffered, and how she was in a very emotional and vulnerable state, and how she was taken advantage of because of that. The main thing that came from the car accident that made it into M3 was the scar that she has. She has a very large scar in her left cheek. And when I had the car accident, I had some damage to my face. I ended up having to go to a plastic surgeon and get glass removed from my face. And it was a big thing. And the scar that Machiavello, the character, has, is my worst fear of what I was going to be left with after the accident. I lucked out. You know, I had a great plastic surgeon, and I have a very small scar on my left side, all things considered. But that was something that was directly from the car accident that made it into the comic.
I notice going off of M3, I believe M3 is very crime-based along with a lot of your other writing, correct?
Yes, I do have a lot of crime thrillers. I would read Law and Order and John Grisham and Tom Clancy, these sort of, you know, government conspiracy, procedural kind of things, and I brought that to M3. The current book that I have out, 12 Levels Dancing, is also a crime story, but it has more of a horror aspect to it, which sort of sets it apart a little bit.
This next bit follows me asking her, with where she's at in her career, does she find herself to be pitching stories more often to companies or companies coming to her with stories that they would like to have written? And her response, I think, is very much what you would expect. It's very much a little bit of both. But to have it best said, I will let her speak for herself.
Well, I mean, I think if there's at any level that you're at writing, you will always be, people will come to you and then you will be pitching stuff out. I mean, you can talk to any writer and they'll tell you, I mean, you look at like Jimmy Palmiotti and Amanda Connor and Justin Gray, they're constantly doing their own books on Kickstarter and stuff. And it's basically, and I remember on Twitter, Jimmy said, you know, I pitch books all the time. And this is Jimmy Palmiotti, somebody who's had, you know, 30 years in the business, creator, artist, writer, you know, Painkiller Jane, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And he's still saying, you know, I still pitch books all the time, and when I can't get somebody to greenlight it, we go to Kickstarter. No matter where you are in your career, that's going to happen. I do have people coming to me asking, hey, what do you have coming up? And I do go and pitch things to publishers. It depends on the publisher, though. I mean, you can't pitch a story, you can't pitch a creator-owned story to Marvel. You know, that doesn't work. When you go to pitch to Marvel, it's basically they've come to you and asked you to pitch. You know, I've done some work for Marvel. I just did a Daredevil annual that came out last month for Marvel. And that sort of gives you an avenue to pitch stories with Marvel characters to particular editors. When you've, anybody can pitch to any company as long as you follow their submission guidelines, which are 99.9% spelled out on their websites. At the same time, it doesn't matter who you really are. Or actually, it's not true. I would say that it does to a certain extent, because some publishers would be more apt to look at a pitch from someone who's already been published than they would be to look at a pitch from somebody who has never published anything. At the same time, well, you know, things happen. People get, you know, a stars align and somebody gets their creator-owned book, you know, picked up by Image or something like that. You know, it's like the Beatles phenomenon. You know, like if the Beatles showed up, you know, 5 months earlier or 5 months later, they might not have been who they are. You know, a lot of it comes down to timing.
Now, these Sam Interviews the World segments are always supposed to be under about 15 to 20 minutes, no longer than 20 at max for sure. And the Erica Schultz interview actually went on for about 40 minutes, just because when an interview is good and when you have the time, you let it go on as long as you can, because you naturally want to get as much information out of them as possible. So I will say this Sam Interviews the World might be split up into two parts. There might be more to come in the future. But for right now, we're going to leave this as the last question that I asked her for the interview, which was, do you feel any pressure when asked to write for these superhero comics? Do you feel that being attached to these figures who are held in such high regard by a certain community comes with any additional pressure? And I think you'll find her response to be fairly interesting.
I don't let that sort of influence me. My main goal at all times is to tell a good story that people will relate to, whether it is a superhero story or a Xena story or Charmed or 12 Levels or whatever. I just want to tell a good story. I think you can tell lots of different stories with all different kinds of characters. So I think that, you know, yes, there's a lot of attention on Daredevil season 3 coming out, and there's a lot of attention on currently on Justice League that's being written by Scott Snyder and stuff like that. But I think if you allow yourself to get sort of influenced by that, you're going to be worrying so much about what you're writing instead of actually doing the writing. And that's kind of I know it's kind of a dummy thing to say, but it's true. I mean, there's a lot of people that sit around and talk about writing but don't actually do the work. So just do the work, get a draft done, whether it's good, bad, or ugly, do it, and then go back and say, okay, we're going to make this better, or we're going to flip this. You know, working on the Daredevil, on the Daredevil script, there was a sequence that I loved and the editor loved, and I really wanted to keep it in. It was a very, sweet comedic and very New York sequence, because I grew up in and around New York, and it was something that was like wholly, purely New Yorker, and unfortunately we had to cut it, but, you know, that's, them's the breaks, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
All right, that does it for another episode of the Flat Knuckle Podcast. A couple of things you can do to help us out. Please leave a 5-star review on iTunes. Subscribe to us wherever you might be listening, be it iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher, and share the podcast with a friend. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook at Flat Knuckle Podcast, and be sure to tune in next Wednesday at 11 a.m. for a brand new episode.